Hello, everybody. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, we lead off with the ice bridges of Michigan. In fact, much of today's program is going to take place in Michigan. It just happened that way. But first of all, ice bridges, the many waterways of the Great Lakes State do much more than transport boats. In the winter, some of those watery depths crystallize into ice bridges that connect disparate places in ways that the summer months do not allow. Those bridges have helped Michiganders of days past, as well as residents today, travel a state for survival, commerce, and recreation. One of Michigan's most publicized ice bridges is the rare phenomenon of Lake Superior freezing to the point that Isle Royale can be accessed from northeastern Minnesota or western Ontario, Canada. It was an Arctic-like situation of that nature that allowed the island's famed moose and wolves to travel from the mainland and take up residence on the island. There are four vessels that provide regularly scheduled passenger service to Isle Royale in season, and one of them, the Ranger 3, has its home base in Houghton, Michigan, along the Keweenaw Waterway. Also known as Portage Lake, that channel between Hancock and Houghton usually freezes up after the close of navigation. Years ago, whenever the human-made bridge between the two cities needed to be closed for maintenance, the repairs would be deferred until winter so that communication between the mainland and the Keweenaw Peninsula could continue over the ice. The Houghton-Hancock Lift Bridge is the only one connecting Michigan's Lake Superior mainland with the rocky finger of real estate known as the Keweenaw Peninsula. And during most of the year, that bridge is the sole non-aquatic path that people can take to get from one side of the waterway to the other. And in the winter, when everything is frozen solid, it is as if the liquid had become dry land for a time, and pedestrians can cross just about anywhere they like from shore to shore. In years past, that ice-covered shortcut was often used by residents of the town of Ripley when traveling to and from Houghton. So a little geography lesson there about the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But one of the busiest ice bridges in Michigan is located along the St. Clair River. During the period in the latter part of the 19th century, 1891 to 1916, the waterway froze solid, shore to shore, just about every year, occurring 5 times in December, 16 times in January, 4 times in February during those 25 years. And when that situation occurred at Port Huron, hundreds of people crossed the hardened river in a single day. Because of the fast current at that location, there are references in newspapers to individuals falling through weak spots in the frozen surface and either drowning or barely surviving the harrowing experience. During the winters, in Port Huron. Some of the town's ice harvest used to come from Sarnia Bay on the Canadian side. And after the ice was cut, an Ontario horse would haul the load to the international border in midstream, where the foreign nag would be unhitched and a native-born United States equine brought up to complete the transit to the Michigan shore. The city of St. Clair, about midway along the river of the same name, was quite bustling when the ice bridge was in place. For example, we look back into the 19th century, 1883, a newspaper noted that 160 teams had crossed the frozen surface there in just one day. 12 years later, another item in a daily publication noted that the road marked out is continually lined with cutters and sleighs. So we're looking at a phenomenon which has occurred for quite some time. Like the St. Clair River, the frozen Detroit River has long served as a seasonal highway between the United States and Canada. People using that wintry road made the crossing for purposes ranging from commerce and business to recreation and socializing. However, most attention on that human movement has been focused on illegal activities, especially those relating to the trafficking of alcoholic beverages. And this was written up in Philip Mason's book, Rum Running and the Roaring Twenties, Prohibition on the Michigan-Ontario Waterway. Because we mainly live in a thawed world today, we are conditioned to think that there must be a bridge or a ferry boat present to cross a river or a bay. But in a frozen world, if appropriate precautions are taken, pedestrians and light vehicles can go just about anywhere a cold wave has turned the water's surface into a thick solid. Those are the ice bridges of Michigan. In a few months, nearly every year, they act as busy highways, though they do not show up on any MDOT, that's the Michigan Department of Transportation map. And I haven't even talked about Lake Erie, which sometimes has the appearance of insects walking across the ice when seen from above. And now, for a look back into the past and Michigan's seed companies. Leading up to the turn of the century, dozens of seed companies were founded in and operated throughout Michigan. Those homegrown businesses circulated colorful catalogs in order to attract prospective buyers, who in turn purchased seeds and other items to raise their own food and flora. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Michigan was home to numerous seed companies. And during that time, farming was widespread and home gardens were common. When reviewing materials such as company catalogs, one can find the names of more than 50 businesses operating in the state. And although they varied in size, those seed companies all followed a similar business model: growing plants, harvesting and processing select plants for seed, packaging that seed, and then selling those packets to farmers and gardeners throughout Michigan. And to assist in the sale of seeds, companies sent out yearly catalogs to prospective customers. Some firms, such as D.M. Ferry and Company, hired major illustrators to create the covers of their catalogs. But most Michigan seed companies managed to produce colorful, attractive catalogs without the help of professional artists to catch the eye of a customer. Well, the catalogs contained a great deal of descriptive information about the businesses they advertised. But their main focus, of course, was the seeds themselves. And one common theme was to compare multiple varieties of crops to show how various seeds produced different results. Most seed companies also sold various gardening and farming related items, such as fertilizers, insecticides, equipment, machinery, animal feed, and even young farm animals. Although most of the companies went out of business or moved out of the state, a few small businesses still grow and sell seed in Michigan. And these include today's Ann Arbor Seed Company, the Great Lakes Staple Seeds, Garden Horde, 45th Parallel Seeds, Oikos Tree Crops, and Nature and Nurture Seeds. And here a description of just one of these companies, the D.M. Ferry and Company. That was Dexter M. Ferry, who was an organizer and junior partner of the firm of M.T. Gardner and Company of Detroit. And that firm was renamed D.M. Ferry and Company in the latter part of the 19th century. In 1886, fire destroyed Ferry's Detroit building, somehow managing to fill all the seed orders for that year. Ferry and Company constructed a new building on the site of the old one, a structure that would stand on that site, Detroit, as a Detroit landmark for many years. The enterprise had facilities in other parts of Michigan, including receiving warehouses at Charlevoix and Harbor Beach, and even a branch store in Windsor, Canada. D.M. Ferry and Company pioneered the practice of providing merchants advertising posters, along with displays that could be assembled in stores. Over the years, the company, later called Ferry Morse, absorbed other seed businesses, and it became the largest operation in the state. Its headquarters moved to California in the 1930s, where it still remains in business today. And so some of the other seed companies were S.M. Isbell and Company, Harry N. Hammond Seed Company, Lorman Seed Company, and Alfred J. Brown Seed Company. I am sure that if you went on the internet, that you would find that some of those are still in business and providing colorful illustrations of their product. It's the beat now, because we're going to talk a little bit about Detroit jazz and Marcus Belgrave, the Motor City's father of jazz. When Marcus Belgrave arrived in Michigan in 1963, He found a home and a niche in the Motor City. A jazz trumpeter who rubbed elbows with countless big-name musicians of the day. Belgrave would become an award-winning performer, educator, arranger, composer, and recording artist, and leave a lasting impression on his adopted city of Detroit. When he was 12 years old, Belgrave became a member of a concert band that performed in Wilmington, Delaware. And there he met the great jazz trumpeter Clifford Brown, whom he later credited with teaching him how to improvise, and who wrote Belgrave's first solo for the jazz standard, How High the Moon. After graduating high school, the young musician's love of music continued. During his stint in the U.S. Air Force, and while stationed in Wichita Falls, Texas, Belgrave heard that Ray Charles' band was performing and made a beeline to the venue to experience that famous group. He was invited to sit in with Ray Charles' crew by the trumpeter who was planning to leave the band. And from that first unexpected opportunity at the after-concert jam, Ray Charles never forgot Belgrave's tone and talent. Once Belgrave was released from the military and returned home to Pennsylvania, Charles offered him a gig playing second trumpet. The 21-year-old packed a bag and hit the road. While Belgrave recognized that Clifford Brown and his cousin Cecil Payne taught him bebop and improvisation, it was Ray Charles who taught him how to play the blues. He worked with Charles from 1958 to 1963 until Belgrave's death in 2015. He was often introduced to audiences as the only living member of Ray Charles' original orchestra. For a brief time, Belgrave had lived in New York and recorded with the famous bass player Charlie Mingus on an album titled Pre-Bird in 1975. Mingus said to a downbeat magazine reporter that if he could pry Belgrave out of Detroit, he would have the perfect band. However, Belgrave was not eager to tour anymore. He turned down offers as well as an opportunity to play with Duke Ellington's orchestra because Detroit was where it was at as far as Belgrave was concerned. Standing approximately 5 feet 5 inches, he was somewhat short in stature, but tall in talent, with an infectious smile and a terrific sense of humor. When he sang, his voice sounded strikingly like Louis Armstrong, almost as if he were channeling the iconic jazz trumpeter. And you may wonder why I picked this particular individual to talk about on our program. It's because I grew up in Detroit and I was familiar with Marcus Belgrave and his jazz. He was, as we said then, a cool cat. Our Michigan program now goes to Lake Michigan. And I don't know if you are aware of it or not, but during World War II, naval pilots were taught how to land on aircraft carriers in Lake Michigan when they were stationed near Navy Pier. In 1942, the U.S. Navy, realizing the need for qualified pilots, who could operate from aircraft carriers during World War II, launched an ambitious project on Lake Michigan. And during the next 3 years, the Navy employed two makeshift flat tops, the USS Wolverine and the USS Sable, to qualify pilots and deck crews. The ships were based out of Chicago, docked at Navy Pier, and operated within the southern basin of Lake Michigan, traversing the waters of Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It's not easy to land on an aircraft carrier. Try doing it at night sometime over the ocean. And then I think you will know what terror is. However, mishaps do occur with training in such an environment, and those mishaps are crashes, resulting in approximately 130 aircraft that crashed and were lost in Lake Michigan. For many years, it seemed that all of the aircraft in the lake would be lost to time. However, beginning in 1988, the National Naval Aviation Museum, with support from the Naval Aviation Museum Foundation, began the effort to recover many of those aircraft. The idea was to locate, to rescue, and restore, and then place the aircraft on display. There were technical and logistical challenges involved, including legal concerns, funding issues, and having to work through the U.S. Navy bureaucracy. However, as the years would pass, a number of these planes have now been recovered, and they have been restored and placed in museums, one of which is the Air Zoo in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You might want to check it out the next time you're in Southwest Michigan. As we near the end of today's program, I want to inject a couple of items about baseball, this being baseball season, of course. And the question comes up, why are fewer African-Americans entering the rosters of Major League Baseball? Throughout the United States, most Americans consider baseball the national sport. A growing number of sports fans, however, may challenge this claim by presenting some recent statistics. In 1981, 19% of Major League Baseball players were African American, but in 2019, the percentage dropped to less than half that number. The decline starts well before the majors. According to the National Sporting Goods Association, 9 million kids between the ages of 7 and 17 played baseball in 2002. By 2013, that figure was 41% lower, as participation throughout the nation declined. Youth leagues and teams had to merge or to shut down, limiting both exposure and access to the sport. Another factor is that many young people today regard the NFL and the NBA as cooler because these games have more ongoing action than active scoring. There is a dimension of preparation time required for Major League Baseball. In Major League Baseball, even the best players must spend several years in minor league baseball where they perfect their skills and ride buses, stay in cheap hotels, and eat too much fast food. The price may be too high for most young athletes, to get to the show. In short, when an NFL prospect or an NBA prospect arrives in rookie camp, he has a far better chance to make the roster by the start of the new season. With increasing number of life-altering injuries in the NFL, and the fact that the NBA limits the number of active players to 15 for each franchise during the playing season, chances are that the percentage of African-American players will probably increase in Major League Baseball. The league, for its part, is trying to enliven the sport's conservative image and recruit more baseball executives and managers of color. All right, my friends, we're at the end of today's program. I want to encourage you to tune in next time to 101.5 FM on your dial to a little of this and a little of that. And so I think it's time for our good friend Willie Nelson to take us on down the road. This is Dan Dillman saying goodbye and good luck.